Hello, everyone. My name's John. I just want to welcome all of you for being here. This is our first ever inaugural episode of the podcast for the College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine. To my left here is my friend and president of the college, Dr. Melvin Spiceman. Mel, why don't you tell us all about this podcast?
Right, John. Thanks for being the producer of the podcast. The podcast is going to be a way for the American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine to teach you about the intersection of AI and healthcare. This is a rapidly evolving area, and so much education is needed worldwide on how to use AI to improve healthcare and save millions of lives worldwide.
That's awesome. Why don't you tell us more about the college?
The American College of Artificial Intelligence and Medicine was launched this August as a professional society, very much similar to the American Heart Association or the American College of Cardiology or the organization that I'm a member of, which is American College of Physicians, which is an internal medicine organization. These professional societies, they're not colleges in the sense that you might normally think of. These are societies that are intended to create an environment of lifelong learning for physicians that are already in practice.
That's awesome. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself personally, if you don't mind?
My background is that I'm from Chicago, and born and raised. I attended college at Northwestern University in Evanston, where I double majored in biological sciences and chemistry, and then attended the University of Illinois College of Medicine in Chicago. Then did residency training in internal medicine and was a chief resident at West Suburban Hospital in Oak Park, and then their core faculty member for over 25 years teaching in the internal medicine residency program. More recently, I was an assistant professor in the Division of Academic Internal Medicine at the University of Illinois College of Medicine here in Chicago, my medical school. I went back to be a professor there. And then this August, I stepped down from that position to start the College of AI to teach physicians and computer scientists and healthcare leaders how to use AI as a tool for good to help patients worldwide.
That's amazing. It seems like you've been very busy. As a Northwestern Wildcat, what do you do for hobbies and things? You go watch any football games during season or anything?
You know, in medicine, it's 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, but I do feel that for wellness, it's important for all physicians to find some hobbies outside of medicine, and I have many. The things that I spend a lot of time on when I can find free time is cycling. I'm into riding a specialized mountain bike and a specialized road bike, and this summer I did a fundraiser bike ride that was 2 days with a team from my lab group in the American College. We rode from Gurney Mills, Chicago, the mall, to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, spent the night, and rode back to Chicago. And this was a fundraiser for another non-for-profit organization called Respiratory Health Association of Chicago. So it was to raise money for lung disease. So that was a bike ride example of a for fun activity that was still linked to healthcare. Travel is really important to me, and I just did a 2-week vacation celebrating my 14th wedding anniversary in the UK. And interestingly, in the UK, in the 1500s, there was a similar organization founded called the Royal College of Physicians, founded by Henry VIII. And that is the original example of a physician organization like our college that's designed for lifelong learning. So travel is big for me. And then I'm deep into the culinary world. I love cooking at a very advanced level. And I have over 100 cookbooks by all the Michelin-starred and James Beard-winning chefs. And Ann and I will, on a special occasion, eat at a 3 Michelin-star restaurant. So during our trip to the UK, we ate at 2 of those for our anniversary. One is called Hélène de Rose. She has 3 Michelin stars, and she was in our her restaurant was in our hotel, the Connaught. And we got to meet her personally, and she autographed her cookbook for me. The other one is that we ate at in the UK was Alain Ducasse's restaurant there. And he's one of my favorite chefs in the world as well, and he's 3 Michelin stars. So to sum up, if I have free time and I want to engage in wellness activities, I do bicycling with either a mountain or road bike, or travel worldwide. My favorite place to travel to is Hawaii. We were married in Hawaii. We've gone over 15 times every year. And then cooking and great restaurants, food. Those are my interests.
It's good to have interest in something like cycling and exercise when your other hobbies are cooking and eating.
Yeah, so you're
I
not
can relate kidding. To that as well. I just need to pick up the cycling or working out or something.
Right. We got to burn as many calories as we take in. Well, maybe you can go riding with me on the trails here in Chicago. I do the Forest Preserve trails. They have great ones.
They're beautiful.
The best one is from here to the botanical gardens. I usually, if I have a full day off, I'll ride there and then walk through the gardens for a few hours and then ride back. That is like a perfect day for me.
That's awesome. Is it true they extended that up to Wisconsin all the way too?
They did. The trails, so there's a throughout the nation, there's been a program for years called Rails to Trails, where old railroad tracks that are no longer in use are converted to bicycle trails. So I do, most of the riding I do is either on those trails or on the Forest Preserve trails. And so, yes, you can easily ride either from Chicago to Wisconsin or Chicago to Indiana without being interrupted on incredible trails. And I hope you do those with me, John.
I will. I'll just probably need an e-bike or something because, you know, I may not have the stamina you do. At least not to start. So I need a little bit of assistance to get me home because, yeah, you don't want to be towing me.
Great. All right. Well, our podcast today that we're going to post is an invited lecture that I gave just 2 weeks ago. I was the guest speaker at University of Illinois College of Medicine in Rockford. And the title of the talk is The Intersection of Artificial Intelligence. And so we're going to pick up this podcast in the midst of that presentation.
Sounds good. Thank you all for joining us, and we hope you enjoy the lecture to come. Welcome to Melvin Mondays.
And now, a lecture from Dr. Melvin Spiceman for November 8th, 2024, at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, Rockford, Illinois, on the intersection of AI and medicine. Enjoy.
The role of the physician is not what you might think it is. And what I mean by that is any physician can engage in artificial intelligence in medicine, even if they don't know how to program, even if they don't know a ton about computers. If they can connect with or reach out to someone who's a computer scientist or a biomedical engineer, they can have a meaningful impact on artificial intelligence in medicine. And the reason I say that is The key role of the physician is what is the important clinical question to solve? And then if you can partner with PhDs or scientists that have the knowledge of how to build these algorithms, magic happens. In the room here is Dr. John Holden, my dear friend. We met at the Illinois State Medical Society and had conversations about this. One of his patients asked him to create an algorithm. He wrote it on paper. He then partnered with computer scientists to make it a reality. That's an inspiration to me. Thank you, John, for inspiring me. So along those lines, I'm sure John is going to get an FDA approval or some kind of approval for his AI-enabled medical device, but let's talk about the FDA approval. So right now in August, this is the most recent update, there are 950 FDA-approved AI as software medical devices. Interestingly, 76% of those are in radiology, because most of AI in medicine thus far has been in imaging. But as we progress through this talk, I will show you the next frontier, which is not imaging, or maybe multimodal, a combination. The other 10% cardiology. So it just gives you a flavor of most of what's been done thus far in AI in medicine has been computer vision, radiology, cardiology. In cardiology, it's still imaging, EKG imaging, echo imaging, CT imaging. But the cool future that I'm hoping to inspire and that John is already doing is algorithms that aren't necessarily imaging that can really impact patient care in a way that is truly, in the past, unimaginable and now a reality. So I'm just trying to give you some flavor of where we are and where we're going, and hopefully spark some excitement for you to collaborate with colleagues to go into this. Now, I'm very quickly going to zoom through the history, because that's not what you're here for. You want to know the future. But it's hard to really do the future well if you don't know a little bit about how we got here. So I'm going to go super fast on this. But this is Alan Turing, and you may hear about a Turing Award, which is like a Nobel Prize in computing. You maybe saw a movie that about him called The Imitation Game, which won all the Oscars about a decade ago. But in a nutshell, he created the computer in 1936, but only on paper. He didn't make the actual computer in 1936. He had published a paper that explains in writing, mathematically, how to make a computer. This is the paper. Someone paid $1 million for his notebook. So I still write in notebooks, so I'm going to save all my notebooks, and maybe, maybe I'll be a millionaire that way. All right. So because we're at a medical college, and you guys are all, like myself, academic, professorial people, I want to tell you that the word artificial intelligence started at Dartmouth in 1956 by John McCarthy. He was a PhD, so Alan Turing was a PhD in math. John McCarthy was a PhD in math. The best student that I have worked with thus far, who's in the University of Illinois GPPA program undergrad, he's going to study math. He's already in the medical school. He's 18. He doesn't want a computer science degree. He's going to get his degree in math. So I'm just emphasizing, this is all mathematical modeling. So good thing you know something about math. Now, I said I'm going to fly through the history, but what I want to tell you is the history of these people that I'm going to quickly tell you about, they all just won the Nobel Prize, all of them. This year's Nobel Prize physics, chemistry, AI. I'll be brief. We can have a conversation in depth if you want. Physics, chemistry, real quick. John Hopfield and Jeff Hinton, they created the neural network. And the best way to think about the neural network is, you know that the brain works by one neuron connecting to another neuron. We all know that. It's nothing, right? But Jeff Hinton and John Hopfield said, let us simulate that using a computer, like nodes that connect, like neurons connect. And that's the neural network. That's what they got the Nobel Prize in physics for. The exact quote of what they got the Nobel Prize in physics for, the foundational discovery that enables machine learning with artificial neural networks. That's Jeff Hinton. This is a schematic that if you read any paper right now on artificial intelligence, you'll see some type of schematic like this. It's a way of showing you visually what a computer neural network looks like, but it's basically mimicking the connection of neurons. That's all it is. So in the 1970, in the UK, Jeff Hinton came up with this idea. He was actually a degree in clinical psychology. But he came up with the idea, let's create a computer that simulates the brain. And that's what this represents. So there ends up being a lot of layers and a lot of connections and then an output. Now that's physics. What about chemistry? So for chemistry, it's about protein and protein folding. And I'll explain why that's important in medicine. So it's interesting to me that everyone that won these awards this year is from the UK. I just returned from the UK. I was there for my vacation, celebrating my 14th wedding anniversary, but all these guys were in the UK. One of them was in a small town when he got notified about it. Not in London, he's in a little town with 1,000 people. I have no doubt that we were near that town, but I was like visiting all these little towns near Bath. So he was like hiding out there so nobody would find him. So DeepMind was a company formed by PhDs, computer science people in the UK. And they are really the true pioneers recently in breakthroughs in AI. And initially, the first projects they did were like, let's have a computer be great at chess or AlphaGo. But then they took that as their, like, what would I say, proof of concept, and they applied it to the medical field, specifically for protein folding. So that the algorithm they developed, which is called AlphaFold and AlphaFold2, you can give them any amino acid sequence and they will predict the folding. And this in medicine will be transformative. It will allow for a new drug discovery, curing diseases in a way you can't even imagine. So it truly is worthy of the Nobel Prize. It's Demis Hassabis and John Jumper that create. This was a 50-year-old problem in science that they solved with AI, predicting the three-dimensional protein structure from an amino. So they've now been able to predict and fold 200 million known proteins. All right, so enough of the background story, the history, because you didn't want to come here for that. You want to know about the future. So some definitions. I had really good advice from one of the top people at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, Anthony Boyd, who's like top of the line in informatics. He's like was responsible for the entire ICD-10 for the nation or something like that. But he gave me good advice. He said, when I started doing this a year ago at University of Illinois, he's like, Mel, this is what you need to do first. You got to learn the terminology really, really well. And everyone I've met since then agrees. So we're going to spend a little bit of time on the terminology. And the reason is everyone in this room is at a different level, and you need to know the terminology to understand the talk. So neural network, we talked about. This is a nice depiction of what a neural network looks like. We already talked about what that is. Machine learning, using data and algorithms to imitate the way humans learn, gradually improving in accuracy. Deep learning is a subset of machine learning that uses a multi-layered neural network, and I kind of showed you that graphically, right, to simulate complex decision-making. Unsupervised learning, this is where it's unlabeled data. What's exciting about unsupervised learning is the computer algorithm will then begin to see patterns that we can never see. It's humanly impossible to see, but the algorithm will see it and discover new things. So I love the unsupervised. Large language model, you know what that is, because everybody in the room here, I'm sure, has used ChatGPT. I would be shocked if someone in the room here did not use ChatGPT. But that's a large language model. There are thousands of them now that are out there. The one that is starting to be used very much by physicians because it's evidence-based is called Open Evidence, something for you to look at, Open Evidence. So what does this GPT stand for? You may or may not know that. It means generative pre-trained transform. We're on the fourth iteration. They're working on five. That would be interesting to see what that looks like. Computer vision is what has been used from 2010 until 2020 to do AI in medicine. This is the pre-LLM era. So all the meaningful breakthroughs in AI in medicine pre 2 years ago were computer vision. That's why everything you see published is about imaging. Computer vision uses a neural network and machine learning to teach computers to obtain information from digital images. Now, what's really interesting about this is that the people who made the breakthroughs in this regard, you're not going to believe this. You know how, like, you might get mad if your kid is on the video games too long, right? The breakthroughs were done by... in the video gaming world. I'm serious. So next time, don't be so mad when your child is on the video game. So much of what we can do in AI and medicine, actually our ability to do the computer vision and at the level we can now is because people building the new video games wanted to make the resolution better. And to do that, they made the computers better. And that's why I could stand here and do this talk right now, because of computer games. Generative AI is generating new things. So, for example, I could ask AI to generate an image of an MRI with a stroke on it that isn't real. It's just created. That's generative AI. The part that is going to be the most relevant to the talk today is autonomous AI, and that is... This is where people get a little fearful, and we can hopefully at the end you can ask me questions that about your fear, and I'm going to try to allay all fears. When you're going to walk out of the room, no fear. So, autonomous AI, computer making the decision, and the only one that is really out there is for diabetic retinopathy, which is what we're going to. So now we're going pure. So I gave you a backstory. Now we're going hard into the clinical part. So. I spent 15 minutes on the backstory. So from 2010 to 2020, the 10 years prior to our current decade, ophthalmology is where it was at. If you wanted to do any artificial intelligence breakthroughs, you were an ophthalmologist. The ophthalmologists were light years ahead of all of us in this, light years ahead of all of us. So the one who's most responsible for meaningful AI in medicine is Michael Abernoff, University of Iowa ophthalmologist. So in 2010, using computer vision, he found a way to look at an image of a retina with a computer and say diabetic retinopathy is present or absent. And he did it in a way that is completely independent of a doctor, no doctor needed. Now, he figured it out in 2010, but it took him almost a decade to get FDA approval. So, John, I'll see you in 10 years, my friend. I'm sure it's quicker now. But more importantly, all right, so more importantly, though, to get people to really use it, he met with Congress and got a Medicare coding for payment for this. So you need to do that. I'm serious. And they said, yes, so there's a Medicare coding to reimburse this without a doctor. That's important. And he actually did all kinds of math to figure out that it has to be $55. And he proved to Congress why it has to be $55. You could talk to, I have his email. We're sort of started to be, I could connect you with Mike if you want to figure this part out. It really, if we're going to implement something, we can't just be oblivious to that right now. I'm serious. Even though this is not my thing. You know, he was smart enough to know, even though he's like a really renowned professor of ophthalmology, that if he doesn't take it to this level, it's not going to be implemented in clinical practice. So the other person that did the same thing, used computers to diagnose diabetic retinopathy, was Lily Pang, who was working at Google. Now, you may be like, well, if Mike Abramoff figured it out, why does Google, because Google wants to get into healthcare things. So they hired Lily out of medical school to work on healthcare related. She has now been, because of this work, stolen by Apple. She's the head of healthcare for Apple because of this project. This, by the way, was a side project. It was not what she was hired to do. They said, okay, everyone at Google, 20% of your time, you could do something for fun. This was her for fun project. Made her world renowned. This is where real creativity occurs. Ann and I are the most creative when we're not at work, when we're like on vacation or it's a day off. That's when the creativity goes. So this was her fun project, and it turned out to be like really the one of the most important developments in medicine. So let's talk about what she did and what Mike did. I'm going to actually, because you guys are professors, and I am an academic clinician, I want to show you the papers and take it down to the level that you want to hear. And what we've learned over the years is the best way to get at a paper in depth is to look at the editorial. So our keynote speaker for our organization this year, American College of Physicians, was Eric Topol. He's a cardiologist at Scripps. He's deep into AI. He wrote a book called Deep Medicine. That is fantastic. I would recommend that if you're interested in learning more about it. But he was the editor on this paper, and he was our keynote at our national meeting this year. He has a fantastic 14-minute TED Talk on AI and medicine that I would encourage you to watch. I'm happy to send it to you. But if you go online and search Eric Topol TED Talk, it is the best thing I've ever seen. It's a quick version of this keynote he gave at our national meeting. It literally will tell you everything you need to know in 14 minutes. What more can you ask for? Eric Topol, TED Talk. But his read on this paper, he's pivotal trial for autonomous AI for primary care. Let's see how I get this to the next one. All right. Well, this is the paper. It was published in a Nature journal called Digital Medicine in 2018. And basically, this was the study that Michael Abramoff gave to the FDA that allowed him to get approval. So you can imagine it's probably a good study. It is. I've looked at it in depth. He, in the study, 900 patients. Where was it done? Primary care clinics. What were the results of this specific study, you ask? Okay, since you ask, I'm going to give you the results. Sensitivity was 87%. Specificity, 90%. What did it show? AI could bring a specialty level diagnosis, like an ophthalmology level diagnosis, to screening for diabetic retinopathy with a really high sensitivity specificity. So, what else? So the editorial was called With an Eye to AI. Isn't that clever? With an Eye to AI. You got to have a clever title to get people interested. So Eric says, in this issue of Digital Medicine, Abramoff and colleagues report the findings of a prospective study for diabetic retinopathy system in primary care. This is a milestone. It really is a milestone in medicine. It was the basis of the FDA approval. And I think what's important is, even now there's a lot of hype, but this is the real thing, man. This is where it's at. This is no hype. This is as good as it gets. So what do we take away from this paper? That deep learning can be used in medicine to diagnose diabetic retinopathy. But more importantly, this is the true proof of concept. If we can do it here, we can do it for all kinds of diseases. So the other similar paper, the one by Google Group in JAMA of 2016. Question, can an automated deep learning algorithm compare with an ophthalmologist? How did they do it? Two validation sets, 9,963 images and 1,748 images. Algorithm had 90% sensitivity and 87%. Oh, no, it says these are the two. So about 90%, this is similar to Mike's data, and then 98 to 99 specificity. So very similar. I mean, we like it when for a problem, there's like 20 different trials, all done independently, show the same thing. That's basically why I'm showing you this paper. But deep learning, sensitive and specific. Okay, so that's ophthalmology. The ophthalmologists get credit for starting all this. But if we can use computer vision to read an image of an eye, we can use it for any imaging in medicine. So the next group of people who used it were radiologists, because what do? Images. Specifically, the one who did this work is Pranav Rajpukar, who's a PhD. So bravo to those here who are a PhD, because he trained at Stanford. Stanford has probably the very best department of AI in medicine. And then what did he do when he was done with the PhD? He went to Harvard to join the biomedical informatics department. Those two programs are the best in the world. So what was his idea? How do we use computer vision to read a chest x-ray? That's what he worked on. He called it something. He called it ChexNet, which I find very hard to pronounce. I don't know about you guys. I struggle with it. ChexNet. It's a 121-layered neural network to read chest x-rays. It's trained on 14 parameters. I typed up the 14 parameters for you. It didn't take that long. So these are the things that it can tell. Atelectasis, pneumothorax, cardiomegaly, consolidation, effusion, edema, infiltrate, emphysema, mass, fibrosis, nodule, pleural thickening, pneumonia, or if there's a hernia. All right, so that's ChexNet. So now we can use AI to read a retina for diabetes, and since then, obviously, other retinal diseases, not just diabetes. That's just the initial. And we can use computer vision to read a chest X-ray. And I will tell you that the studies show that it outperforms the radiologist, and especially once it gets to after 3 p.m., this is true, after 3 p.m., when human beings start to fatigue, that's when the computer vision really outperforms the radiologist. It doesn't get tired. It's well rested at that time.
I just wanted to add to this thing that, I work on lung
Yes.
cancer, and people who are screened for lung cancer,
Yes.
they have a chest, they have an, the LDCT scan, but
Yes.
now MIT and has developed a program by which they can, and it's very difficult to predict because the lesions are very small, whether the person has lung cancer or not.
Right.
And from those images, they've been able to find out with 97% accuracy whether this person has lung cancer or not with the AI program from MIT. So this chess business is getting pretty advanced now.
Thank you for saying that. At the end, I will show you our lab groups that we have that you, our guys, are welcome to join. But Ryan Nguyen, who is an oncologist, graduate of the oncology program at the University of Illinois, who's now the precision medicine oncologist for the Chicago campus and is hosting for the entire city precision oncology tumor boards. This is the work he does. And he runs our AI and medicine oncology lab group. And any of you guys are welcome to be part of that. So he is the physician who's doing that. And Matthew, I'm trying to have him be the PhD person that runs our AI and oncology lab group. So that's just giving you a flavor of how we're doing this, right? We have PhDs, we have MDs collaborating, doing what you just described, which is transformative, really, in
Right,
medicine.
so we and Dr. Salahuddin, who is at the oncology at UIC, so we are trying to implement that, that program and try to use it on our
Right,
patients.
I love it.
So that's something we're trying to
So
do.
the part that I'm sharing you what can be done in theory, implementation has been not really happening yet. I will tell you at the end what's happening in reality as of today. But all this has been worked out, but in terms of getting it done in reality, meaning having doctors use it, still not quite there yet. There's a lot of barriers, as you could imagine. I'm sure you guys can appreciate that. But hopefully you'll join our AI for Good program and help us implement it in reality. So we talked about ChexNet. Then this paper I really want to spend a few extra minutes on because this one is really amazing. So this is still the radiology topic. This was a paper published by the University of Illinois College of Medicine. That's why I'm emphasizing to this group. By one of my mentors, Bill Galanter. Now, Bill kind of was the guru who helped all these other people. Now, Bill is an MD, but he's also a PhD. We were in medical school together 30 years ago, but he got his PhD work is in, what do you think? Math, MATH. And everyone at the University of Illinois, Chicago campus, who does anything comes to Bill because he knows how to do the math. So he's like indispensable. So Bill has been mentoring me at least once a month for the last year. We just visit and talk AI, and he's been guiding me. But he did an amazing paper here that I was just spending a minute on. This is going to blow your mind. So he can have computer vision, look at a chest X-ray, no lab work, nothing. Just look at the chest X-ray and say, there's diabetes. How is that possible? No lab work. Just look at a chest X-ray. These are patients that have never been diagnosed with diabetes. They don't know they have it. Imagine the screening potential here. So I will show you how it works. Hopefully, you're wondering, how does this work? How is this possible? See, it's this kind of thing that is so cool that makes me want to really work in this space. So first they had to train the model on 271,000 chest x-rays. But now it can look at an x-ray and say if there's diabetes or not. So remember when we like learned the statistics and we had, you know, the true positives and the true negatives, and you're like, why am I doing that? Because of this right here. So this is a beautiful 4x4, right? Or 2x2, whatever you call it. I don't even. But this shows you the true positive. And then the others. Now, when I gave this talk last time, someone asked me, well, how is it that AI can diagnose diabetes from a chest x-ray? Well, this is a visual of it, but I'm going to give you the answer. Central fat distribution, which we as humans are not going to see when we look at the chest, but the computer will. Specifically, central fat in the mediastinum, upper abdomen, and supraclavicular regions, and attenuation of the ribs and clavicles. So this is how it does it. And this is when we talk about this unsupervised learning, seeing patterns that we as humans will never be able to see. That's the power of AI in medicine. So, summary points on this paper, that using deep learning, you could accurately identify type 2 diabetes on a routine chest x-ray. Now, I'm really big into prevention, and I feel like more than being able to treat diabetes or high blood pressure, I want to prevent diabetes and high blood pressure. This is really an important paper in that regard, because a lot of chest x-rays are done, and you could then tap into that and identify diabetes in people that have no idea they have diabetes. So starting preventive medicine and implicating lifestyle changes to reduce the risk of diabetic complications. That's like the meaningful use of this kind of a AI and medicine tool. All right, so we covered ophthalmology, we covered radiology. Now we're going into gastroenterology. I felt very fortunate. In our Department of Medicine, they brought in Tyler Bierzon, actually funded by the American College of Gastroenterology, as a guest speaker, the way I'm a guest speaker today. He was the one at Harvard that did this original work on putting AI into a colonoscope. So now in the U.S. in 2024, most gastroenterologists, if they do a colonoscopy on you, AI is embedded in it. And that's a good thing. This is one of over 33 papers on this idea. And it's about the human being misses polyps. We're human. But we can miss fewer polyps if we let AI help us. So my main message is AI is a tool like the stethoscope. Use it to help you. That's what I want you to take away from today. Don't be afraid of it. It's not going to replace you. It's just a tool to help you. So in this paper, we could see why that would be. So this was done at 8 centers, which is good. Done in Italy, the UK, the US. It's randomized. Now, this part is weird. The patient had the colonoscopy one day and another one the next day. That's a lot, right? But they agreed. And one day it was done with AI, and one day it was done without AI. And I wouldn't have signed up for that study myself. But all right. But it worked. That was background results. So 230 subjects, 116 AI first, 114 had the standard colonoscopy first, and then the other way around. I'm sure you follow, right? So the miss rate went from 32% down to 15%. So a 50% reduction in missing polyps. Conclusion, twofold reduction in missing polyps. There's a benefit in adding AI. So this, as I mentioned, you know, you shouldn't just have one trial. We love in evidence-based medicine to have 20 trials showing the same thing before we want to do it. 33 trials, 27,000 patients confirmed the same thing. So Tyler said when he gave the grand rounds a few months ago at the Chicago campus that, and I haven't verified this, I'm going to trust that he's right on this, that the field of medicine that has the most randomized trials in artificial intelligence is gastroenterology. And these are the trials right here. So the head of GI, gastroenterology, at the University of Illinois College of Medicine is A.J. Mutlu. And we've known her for 20 years. She was a chief resident when we were teaching. So she went from being our chief resident to being the head of GI at the university. I'm so amazingly proud of that. But I talked to her at that conference, and she said, University of Illinois Department of GI didn't have any AI-enabled scopes and didn't have a budget for it, but she is so resourceful, she got the company that makes it to give it to her department for free. So I thought that was a cool story to share with you. Make the ask. Cardiology. This is a topic that I am most interested in. Over the last year, my projects at the University of Illinois and AI centered around heart failure and AI. But as I told you, the keynote address at ACP was Eric Topol. And these are some of the things he said. And I'm not going to show you the full papers, but he said that AI can read an EKG and tell you the ejection fraction without having an echo. And I have a separate talk on AI and cardiology that I'm happy to come back in the future to give that to you and go deep into some of these things. But to me, that's unbelievable. EKG, AI's looking at it, no echo needed. Know the EF like instantaneously. Amazing. AI can look at, computer vision can look at the EKG, and without AFib ever having been present, ever, it could say this patient will get AFib. In the future, predict the future. Computer vision can look at an EKG and say there's diabetes. I'm serious. It can look at an EKG and say there's hypothyroidism without knowing the blood tests. It can tell you there's kidney disease without knowing the blood. It can tell you there's anemia without knowing the blood. That was the TED Talk. If you're interested, Eric Topol. He doesn't pay me anything. I haven't even met him. I'm going to give you a mini version of my cardiology talk, and then we'll be done shortly. So the three things I talk about with AI and cardiology are AFib, heart failure, and MI. So I'm sure you heard about this 2019 paper in New England Journal about AFib and the smartwatch, because it got a lot of press, so to speak. But if not, I'm going to teach you about it briefly. If you want a deep dive, invite me back another time. Raise of hands, how many people here are wearing a smartwatch today? I'm very curious. Okay, a low number. When I normally survey people I've given various talks like throughout the week here at some different hospitals in Chicago. Usually 50% of the people in the room have a smartwatch. Today it's 4. It's not out of the group. Yes. You are one. Yeah, okay. Oh, see, you have a good cardiologist. I like that. He's cutting edge. All right. So a little background. How does this work? There's optical sensors on the watch. So if you have an app downloaded, it can see if you have an irregular rhythm. And if so, if the watch detected the irregular rhythm, they mailed to the person a patch that's essentially a heart monitor to wear for 7 days at home to verify that it's a fit. So that's kind of the backstory. Because half of Americans, it's like 45%, it's not quite fit, 45% of Americans have a smartwatch on them right now. They were able to recruit 419,000 participants. Now, of those, only less than 1%, a half of 1% actually had AFib, 2,000 screened positive during this study. But what did we find? That you can get a regular pulse notification with the watch and detect AFib. So that was called the Apple Heart Study. Another similar thing within cardiology that I want to talk about is heart failure, just briefly, and then this one, MI. So heart failure, there have been many, many papers in the last 12 months, and actually quite a few in the last 4 weeks, on computer vision looks at the EKG and tells you heart failure or not. No echo needed. So that's going to be transformative, I think. Especially someone acutely short of breath in the emergency room, it can instantaneously tell you if it's the heart or the lungs. And it beats BNP. So for those of you that are really clinical, like in the audience, it's better than the brain natriuretic peptide, which is the gold standard for initially determining if someone's in heart failure or not. How can we use it for MI? An important thing that Ann and I talk about almost every day is, will this AI really be needed? Is it necessary? Can we do it without AI? If we could do it without AI, why do we need to use AI? I want to show you that maybe it could help for MI. And that's the ARISE trial, A-R-I-S-E. In other words, the computer vision to say whether there's an ST elevation or not on the EKG. And so obviously it can do that very accurately, but the reason it can help for someone with an acute MI, and this is published in New England Journal AI. So in January, New England Journal started to publish New England Journal AI, which we subscribe to. It's only a digital journal. But if you really want to follow all the stuff that I'm telling you about, it's worth a subscription, New England Journal AI. And so this paper came out not too long ago. It says published June of 2024. And it basically showed that you could, if you had the computer vision right in the emergency room when the patient first comes in, read the EKG, and if it says ST elevation MI, it text messages instantaneously the cardiologist who's on call for the cath lab. So it reduced the door to needle time significantly. So that's the ARISE trial. All right. And then the last topic I want to cover is primary care. While I was at University of Illinois doing all this stuff, I was also doing primary care. I've been a hospitalist for 25 years, but I did primary care recently. I love primary care. And I told you, preventive medicine is where it's at. But while I was doing that, the way it's structured everywhere across the nation is you have no choice. You have to see 3 patients an hour, 8 hours a day, 24 patients a day. That's it. Doesn't matter what hospital you go to, doesn't matter what state, that's what it is. 3 patients an hour, 8 hours a day, 24 patients a day. I can do that like nothing because I've been practicing for 30 years. So then what's the problem? For each hour you spend with a patient, you need 2 additional hours to do the EMR documentation. This is a fact. This is in the literature right now. It's science. So let's do the math on Mel Spiceman. I saw 8 hours worth of patients plus a 1 hour lunch break, 12 to 1. 8 hours patients. Now I have 16 more hours of documentation plus my 1 hour lunch. Is that 24 hours or? You see the problem here, right? So they call it pajama time, meaning you go home, you put your pajamas on, and then you don't have a life. You just go on the computer and you document for 16 hours. This is what's going on. And to the point where I'm sorry to tell you that more than 50% of physicians are dropping out of they went to medical school, now they're quitting because of this. But guess what? It's been solved by AI. And at two major academic centers in Chicago in March, the AI-enabled note writing was implemented, one at Rush and one at Northwestern. Problem solved. If you don't have it yet, hopefully you'll get it one day. I don't know. So it really does restore the doctor-patient relationship. Like, I didn't want to like do this when I'm, let's say you're seeing me right now. I don't want to do this. I want to do this. I want to hear you. I want to see what you have to say. I don't want to just type. And then I don't want to go home until midnight and try to type it all in there either. So this is when I told you about implementation of AI in clinical practice, this is what's being done now for real. So I'm ending with the reality of what is already been done now since the beginning of the year, and it's being expanded. So in academic, again, I'm not promoting any brands, but I want to tell you that the University of Chicago and a lot of the really big name academic centers are using a brand called Abridge. And the reason they're using it is it's developed by us, by professors of medicine. Abridge, A-B-R-I-D-G. Actually, a cardiologist from one of the East Coast universities developed Abridge. I'm not promoting, it's just one of hundreds of brands of ambient listening note writing systems that you could choose. So, but it might be worth like just checking that out just to learn about it. The one that Rush uses is called Suki. It's a small company that just tried to solve the problem of note writing. So there's a lot of startups, AI startups, working on this that have products that you could use right now. So ambient listening is, the best way I can explain this to you is think of the Alexa speaker. Now, I don't have an Alexa speaker, but in every weekend I visit my mother-in-law. She's 99. Don't tell her that I told you that. She'll kill me. But she's 99. And in her room, we put an Alexa speaker. So if she's in trouble, she could say, it doesn't say call me, though. It says call Jim. So we taught her to say call Jim, who's nearby, and he can come and help. Anyway, so the same technology that's in an Alexa speaker is what is being used. So it's basically, the speakers in the room, like, you know, if you have an Alexa speaker, it's listening to everything you say at all times, right? So that's, you put that in the doctor's office. Now I can do this. I don't have to do this. You tell me the story. It's going to put it all into a note and the problem list and the coding and the bill. It's amazing. And then I can go back to the like core of why I wanted to be a doctor, that doctor-patient relationship, which has been really eroded by the EMRs. If you talk to any doctor, they'll tell you it's been eroded by the EMRs. Like when I, most of my career, I could handwrite my note. You couldn't read it, but I could handwrite my note. Now you could read everything, but I don't have a moment to myself. So this to me is amazing. I love it. I would encourage every physician to do this, have an ambient listening system that does their note-taking so they can restore the doctor-patient relationship. So take-home points. All right. So first thing you learned today, the Nobel Prizes all went to AI people. The second thing you learned today, So the caveat to that is if you want a Nobel Prize, you got to work with myself and Anne in the future. The second, the ophthalmologists found a way to diagnose diabetic retinopathy without a physician. The radiologists found a way to read an x-ray without a radiologist. The gastroenterologists found a way to add AI to the scope so that they don't miss your cancer when they do your colonoscopy. If you're John Holden's doctor, tell him to wear a smartwatch to diagnose AFib. You can actually use computer vision to diagnose CHF with just on an EKG, or diabetes, or thyroid disease, or anemia, or kidney disease, according to Eric Topol. And in primary care, you could use it today for sure if your hospital or health system is willing to spend a fortune on an ambient listening system. So don't say that I didn't teach you something today, you know. So, labs. I hope all of you have a lab. When I met with the chairman of my department and the head of research, I wanted a physical lab. And they're like, there's not a whole lot of space available here. I said, well, what if I make a virtual lab? They said, sure, we don't mind. Best thing I ever did. Why? Because I'm worldwide now. Anyone can work with me. I have students, residents, professors worldwide. Not kidding. So in cardiology, Lou Ivanovich was a fellow and a chief fellow at University of Illinois College of Medicine. Shout out to Lou. Lou is in Arizona right now. He does CT of the heart. His hospital has the most powerful CT scanner of the heart in the world, and he is about to do randomized trials with us on AI for CT diagnosis of coronary artery disease. We have a very robust pulmonary critical care group about to publish papers on AI relating to critical care and pulmonary. I told you about our oncology program with Dr. Ryan Wynn and Matthew. But we have every subspecialty, cardiology, pulmonary, renal, GI, hem-onc, ID, neurology, endocrinology, OB-GYN, ophthalmology, orthopedics, pediatrics, hospital medicine, primary care, mental health. Ann and I are about to publish 4 papers on AI for diagnosis and treatment of depression. Depression. And we are both experts in autism, and our next projects are AI and autism, if anyone's interested. And then I'm about to publish on the medical education. So I didn't tell you this at the beginning, but my true passion has always been medical education, medical student and resident education, and with my UIC and AMHSA students nationwide, we're about to publish on how to use AI for medical education in this entering class medical school for this fall. Every medical school has a committee and a policy on how they're going to implement right now this year for. It's already started, right, a couple months ago. This class is this class nationwide is the first class that is having AI fully, formally implemented into their curriculum. So it's here to stay.
And well, thank you so much for that, Professor Spiesman, explaining the intersection of artificial intelligence and medicine, which is all new to me. But anything else you'd like to send us out with here before we go?
Well, if you liked what you heard on the podcast today, you can learn more about the intersection of artificial intelligence and medicine at our website, www.americancollegeaim.org. On that site, you can become a member of our college. Also, we'll be having a national annual conference, the scientific session on this topic, September 20th, 2025, in Chicago at McCormick Place. You'll find information on the website as to how to register to attend. Also, if you want to support our AI for Good movement, we are a 501(c) non-for-profit with a mission to educate students, residents, attending doctors, computer scientists, and healthcare leaders on how to use AI for good. You can donate on our website to our nonprofit organization. Moving forward, future podcast episodes will be released every other Monday. John Holmblad here, the producer, will be doing so on Melvin Mondays.
That's right, Melvin Mondays.
Hopefully we'll see you then.
Thank you all so much for joining us this first ever Melvin Mondays, and we hope to see you again. Bye.